May it please the court. My name is Barry Schwartz, registration number 17981, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant or appellants here, and I know we'll come back to that issue shortly. But before we get there, and I would like to, I know I'm the keeper of my own time here, I'm going to try to reserve 3 minutes. As the court knows, this case involves a rear-end automobile accident that occurred on Santa Fe Drive in Denver involving a police officer. And the primary issue in the court, before the court, is whether the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act immunizes Denver and Officer Jossi from suit. In order for the plaintiffs to prevail in this case, they have to prove that they have to demonstrate, and the burden is on them, that Officer Jossi exceeded the speed limit, the applicable speed limit, we'll say for now, and that in doing so, she endangered life or property. It's incumbent on the plaintiffs to show both.
Well, I'm gonna jump in right away, Mr. Schwartz, and maybe you can help me out here, because I have the question for both of you. I think this is a very interesting issue of statutory interpretation here. So I'm gonna tell you kind of where I think it looks like, and then I have a question. And what I'm coming to is, do you really need to show both speed and endanger? So the Immunity Act basically says, waive sovereign immunity, and I'm going to paraphrase badly, waive sovereign immunity unless you're within the emergency vehicle exception. So then you look at that, which is 42.4108, and you look at 2, and it says, a driver of an emergency vehicle may exceed the lawful speed set forth in 11.01.2 or exceed maximum lawful speed in 11.01.8, so long as the said driver does not endanger life or property. And then you go into what those other sections talk about. So I had really two questions. First of all, I think it's clear that if we're in 42.4108.2, then there's no waiver of sovereign immunity if we're within that. First question is, are we within that if the officer didn't speed? I mean, you assume if the officer didn't speed, there's automatically immunity because we're not in that exception to it. And I'm not sure that's right. I'm not sure because you arguably could get to, well, we're not within 2 because we don't have an issue of the officer exceeding lawful speed. So could you look at 402.4? Which says the driver is not relieved from the duty to drive with due regard for safety. My question is, if you're not speeding, do we have an issue of being within 42.4108.2 at all? Which does say speeding, you can speed as long as you don't endanger life or property. That's one question, and my second question is going to be, if you if you drive too fast for conditions, is that speeding? Basically, under the other statutes. I have the same questions for your colleagues on the other side, so they get 15 minutes to think about it, I guess.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, the question of whether it falls within, just those words are it's hard to know what that means, but the answer is, under Corsentino versus Cordova, the Tungit case, Fodd versus Macaluso, I believe that it's quite clear that you have to be doing both, and that if you're not speeding, then endangering life and property does not waive immunity. And in fact, in Tungit, the court expressly held the court expressly held that a violation of 42.4108.4. Driving without due regard for the safety of others does not constitute a waiver. So, I mean, I think that the law on that is fairly clear and straightforward.
All right, so as I pause a little on Corsentino, because it says the question is whether a driver's speed created an unreasonable risk. Maybe it does come back to my second question, which was, if you drive too fast for conditions, is that speeding under those other referred to statutes?
Well, I think not. And one of the and I believe that Corsentino and Fogg make that clear. But I think that another reason for that is the statute itself. 42.4108 it says exceeding the lawful speed set forth in 42.4.11.01.2. And 11.01.8, and we can talk about that, but it doesn't include 42.4 I'm sorry, 42.411.01, which is the equivalent of driving too fast for conditions. So we have cases that have expressly excluded that and said that 42.410.84, a violation of 42.410.84 does not constitute a waiver of immunity. But also, if the General Assembly had intended for driving too fast for conditions to constitute it, they would not have limited the language in 42.410.82C. They would have included 11.011 as well as 11.012 and 11.01.
Mr. Schwartz, I guess the problem I'm having with that part of your argument is that subsection one, I understand, is not specifically referred to, but it seems to be a fairly general provision. And then you go into subsection two, it talks about a special hazard, and that seems to be a slightly more specific version of one, conditions. I mean, if there's no one around, the roads are icy, you know, that could be conditions for most people, but I'm wondering how subsection two and subsection one correlate.
Well, it's not entirely clear, and I think that, frankly, the answer is they don't. But with respect to special conditions, I mean, I did address that.
Special hazard, excuse me,
in the brief. I think the problem with that isn't the problem you raise. It's the problem of predictability. And that is, how does a police officer or a driver any kind of an emergency vehicle gauge their behavior in a world where somebody says, that was a special hazard. What's a special hazard? I address that in the brief. I'm not sure that the court has to address that issue, Judge Boris, because there was a finding that there was construction, but the court didn't find that there was a special hazard. And I'm not sure what that is under Colorado law.
Well, Mr. Schwartz, if special hazard is indefinite, is that any more indefinite than taking account of the road conditions or driving too fast for the road conditions, or excuse me, endangering people's lives or safety?
I think that endangering life and property is more specific enough, and certainly in the realm of statutes, the specificity of statutes that courts have to interpret and review, and that police officers have to be mindful of, that one is specific enough. But I think that a reasonable person in the world, certainly a police officer, will have a better sense of what is endangerment than they would of what is a special hazard on a roadway.
Well, yes, you may well be right, but ultimately it seems to me that comes down to a question of judgment on the part of a police officer, and then looking after the fact to see whether the police officer's exercise of judgment was appropriate. But it's different from saying that you can't drive over 50 miles an hour in a particular area. It's more indefinite from that perspective.
That's true, and I frankly cannot give you an answer that does away with the uncertainty in that.
So let me ask you then about the special hazard provision. Are you saying, does that apply at all in your view, in terms of what is considered speeding in an emergency or not?
I believe not, Your Honor, and say that with trepidation because there is a general adoption, frankly, of that whole statute in the Immunity Act, and certainly the language special hazard is in there. But I would say that this, forgetting the fact that that statute was adopted and brought into the Governmental Immunity Act, that's the statute that contains the special hazard language exists for a different purpose, and that statute exists. That is the General Assembly's way of telling municipalities and public entities what speed limits they're allowed to set. So
I understand you made that argument in your brief, but the language of special hazards, though, again, is more indefinite than the provisions dealing with specific speed limits. Isn't that correct?
I believe that it is correct.
Well, let me add a similar wrinkle, I suppose. In terms of special hazard, 42.410.82 says you can exceed the lawful speed limits in 42.411.012 if you endanger life. All right, so then we look over 42.4.11.012, which says, except when a special hazard exists that require a lower speed, the following speed shall be lawful. So don't we need to know if the officer, if there was a special hazard, to decide if the officer exceeded the lawful speed in 42.4.11.012?
Well, not necessarily, because I mean, if it's established, if it's established that a special hazard existed, yes. But otherwise, the language in 42.4.11.01 that sets speed limits, I think that what the statute means is the officer can't exceed a posted speed, and if there is no posted speed, then you speed limit. You look at 42.4.11.01. And then in no event can an officer drive more than 75 miles an hour.
But doesn't that write out this language, except when a special hazard exists? Your argument seems to me is not factoring that in at all. Because 42.4.11.108 specifically takes us to 11.012.
Correct.
Which begins with except when a special hazard exists.
Right. It's, I don't know how to answer that other than to say that that is certainly part of the statute. The court's going to have to chew on that gristle to the best, to the extent it can. But as a practical matter, in the world of police officers, how do they gauge their conduct when they're driving? What's a special hazard? How does an officer know what that is? So it does have to be factored into it. And certainly in this case, you know, getting to how you resolve this case, the court didn't do that. It said that there was construction, and certainly there was, but it didn't make a finding as to whether or not there was a special hazard.
Let me ask you a question about practical application.
Yes.
So if we're just looking at speed limits, the posted speed limits, as I think you're asking us to do.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I understand your brief, you're asking us to look at the time of impact as the moment when the posted speed limit would be relevant. Okay, so if you have a police officer who's speeding, and then within 7 seconds breaks and manages to break down below the posted speed limit, then that's one situation. But if they break and they are 1 mile over the posted speed limit, then that's a whole different situation. So it's very difficult to understand how posted speed limit at the moment of impact really plays out.
Well, Your Honor, in light of that very concern, mm-hmm. Well, the way I tried to couch it in my brief is not at the moment of, but a reasonable time prior to. And what I would say to that is, at a time, exceeded the posted speed limit at a time that it might have affected the consequence of what occurred. Now, in this case, assuming that the speed limit was 45, the officer did not, it's uncontroverted that the officer didn't exceed the posted speed limit of 45 for 18.8 seconds prior to the accident. So in that case, just as applied here, that's not a concern. But in the broadest sort of legal interpretive sense, it is a problem. Certainly, if the officer was going 46 2 seconds before and 44 2/10 of a second before, that's not a distinction that helps the court.
Could the trial court have gotten there by crediting certain of the eyewitnesses rather than the police investigation and the equivalent of the black box?
Well, Your Honor, Appendix A to my brief speaks to that issue. My answer to that question is no. I think that the evidence, and certainly I understand what the court has to do in interpreting conflicting evidence, but I don't think that the evidence presented with respect to speeds, which were anywhere from 30 to 75 miles an hour, people made guesses as to the posted speed limit at a posted speed limit that doesn't even exist, which is 40. The evidence, the Exhibit 5, Exhibit D, the method for handling traffic, the testimony that the accident occurred 706 feet north of that mile marker is really unequivocal.
Mr. Schwartz, I know your time is running out, but I just wanted to ask you, is your view that a reasonable time here is that 18.8 seconds to determine whether or not the car was speeding, or could it have been 20 seconds or 25 seconds?
Well, I think 18.8 is fine, but an amount, you know, 18.8 seconds driving at the speed that that the plaintiff says she was driving, she wouldn't even be on that same street. So it would have to be at a time when it might have impacted, where it might have had an effect on the accident that subsequently occurred.
Okay, thank you.
And if that doesn't answer, I'll use my last 15 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz.
If I could just have a couple of them.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Charlie Crichton. My attorney registration is 38557, and sitting with me at council table is my co-counsel, Steve Kaufman. The statutory case law clearly supports the trial court's findings that Officer Josie exceeded the lawful speed, that her conduct endangered life and property, and that the plaintiff's injuries resulted from her conduct. Now, in reviewing the trial court's findings, it's important to first look at the statutes regarding government immunity. And those statutes tell us that Officer Josie was exceeding the lawful speed. First statute to look at, obviously, is 2410-106, stating that sovereign immunity is waived for injuries resulting from the operation of a motor vehicle, except emergency vehicles operating within the provisions of 42-4-108, subsection 2 and subsection 3. Now going to 42-4-108, subsection 2, which is a statute obviously that applies to this case, it describes when immunity is waived by an emergency vehicle operator. It states, emergency vehicle operators may exceed the lawful speeds set forth in 42-4-1101, subsection 2, or exceed the maximum lawful speed limit set forth in 42-4-1101, subsection 8, so long as said driver does not endanger life or property. Now, there's a couple things I want to point out here. Exceed the lawful speeds or exceed the lawful speed, maximum lawful speed limits. There's a distinction and a difference between those two terms. And there's a distinction between a lawful speed and a maximum posted speed limit. Court obviously understood the importance of the statute in stating, quote, the only applicable statute that does apply here is 42-4-108, subsection 2, subsection C, which relates to speed. Now going on to 42-4-1101, which I'm going to refer to as the lawful speed statute, it describes exactly what a lawful speed is. It states, quote, except when a special hazard exists that requires a lower speed, the following speed shall be lawful. And then subsections A through G lists a variety of different lawful speeds. And then we have subsection H, any speed not in excess of a speed limit designated by an official traffic control device. Now here, except is the key word, because ordinarily any speed not in excess of a traffic control device is lawful. But if a special hazard exists, that otherwise lawful speed may not be lawful.
How do we know what a special hazard means?
Well, I'm just getting to that. That is subsection 3 of that same statute. Mm-hmm. And subsection 3 of 42-4-1101 states, when a special hazard exists with respect to pedestrians or other traffic, or by reason of weather or highway conditions. So that gives us some guidance in terms of what a special hazard would be. Now going back to 42-4-108, again, it goes to lawful speeds and cites 42-4-1101, subsection 2, rather than stating just posted speed limits. Again, there's this emphasis on a lawful speed versus a posted speed limit.
So, Mr. Crichton, let me interrupt your dissertation and ask you the practical question that Mr. Schwartz alluded to. So, during this event that led to the collision, Officer Josie is driving and trying to get to someplace in a hurry, and she sees that she's driving through a construction zone. So, and let's assume that she's intimately familiar with the statutes, and she says this construction zone creates a special hazard. How is she to determine whether that allows her to go at 40 miles an hour, 45 miles an hour, or 56 miles an hour, or any other speed?
Well, I think just like any other driver does, you have to take into account the hazards on the road and the time she's driving down there.
Except the one difference is that Officer Josie can drive faster than the posted speed limits, whereas you and I cannot.
And that's correct. But when driving above the posted speed limits, she does have a responsibility to take into account any special hazards, such as the construction you've alluded to, the heavy traffic, the bad lighting. It's no different than taking into the totality of the circumstances under Corsentino, and that she has to be responsible for driving as any other driver would. And as an officer, she has kind of a heightened, she has almost a heightened responsibility to take into account special hazards and the totality of the circumstances when she's driving, because when she's doing what she's doing, exceeding the posted speed limit, she's putting everybody else at risk.
Well, how do you read special hazard here? I mean, and I'm really picking up on Judge Talman's question. Does it mean that if there's a special hazard, she can't exceed the speed limit, or does it mean the speed limit becomes a different speed?
I think it means that the speed limit becomes a different speed. Going back to Judge Boris's example, if we have an officer, let's say, going down I-25, and let's say there's rush hour traffic at 5 o'clock, it's bumper to bumper, and it's icy and snowy conditions, and that officer, rather than slowing down, decides to go 64 miles an hour. Well, that may be below the posted speed limit of 65, but if an accident occurs, she's certainly not going the lawful speed. And if an accident happens, that officer should be liable.
So doesn't the court, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr.
No, please.
So doesn't the trial court on your analysis of the statute have to tell us, make a finding here, what the lawful speed was under those circumstances, and then make a finding that it was exceeded?
And Your Honor, I think the trial court made findings that basically, while not stating that precisely, did make findings regarding the special hazards and stated specifically that they required a higher degree of caution and lower speed.
Sure, but the court, for us to know if the officer exceeded the speed limit for purposes of 42.4.1082, exceeded the lawful speeds, I should have said, don't we need to know what the court viewed as what the lawful speed was in those circumstances? Don't we need a finding?
Well, I think the court does make findings about in that regard, although they are imprecise.
But although the problem that I have, with all due respect to the trial court judge, who I respect a lot, she said, there's an interesting question about whether she exceeded the speed limit. It's worth commenting, and she goes on about the evidence. She talks about the conflicting evidence, and then she focuses on endangering life or property. And it's hard to see where, so she made a lot of findings that I was expressing concern, but it seemed to me that concerns came in the endangered property and people category more than what the speed was. So, and forgive me, but I'm still not, I guess I'm not understanding whether you think, and I guess my question is, do we need a remand here? Do we need the court to make a finding that this is what the lawful speed is in this situation? I conclude that the officer exceeded it, and then I include endangerment. Because we've got pretty good findings. She thinks there was endangerment, but I'm not so sure we have findings that let us decide this question on lawful speed.
And Your Honor, I don't think that's necessary. Corsentino, going to the Corsentino case, obviously, trial courts to consider these types of cases under the totality of the circumstances. And there's no specific requirements in terms of what findings need to be made in terms of a lawful speed or what the speed limit was. And it's really based on this totality of the circumstances.
But the totality gets us to the statute. I mean, we as an appellate court have to say, you know, look through the statute and your chart is very helpful. It's the analysis I did myself. How do we not make a determination of whether you exceeded? We can't find a waiver of immunity unless we know if she exceeded lawful speed and endangered life or property.
Well, and Your Honor, I don't know if this is responsive to your question, but there is evidence that she did exceed the posted speed limits as well. And that evidence actually is there. Obviously, Mr. Schwartz alluded to the fact that she did exceed those posted speed limits, 18.8 and 20.2 seconds prior to this accident occurring. There was also evidence from the crash data recorder that she was exceeding the posted speed limits, I believe at 7.6 and 7.2 seconds prior to impact. And then there were no entries for 7.5 and 7.3 seconds prior to impact, but that she was braking at the time, which would indicate clearly that she was above the speed limit, since those entries at 7.6 and 7.2 seconds prior to impact indicated that she was going 45 miles an hour. Obviously, an officer who was going 45 miles an hour with the brakes applied in that intervening period was above the speed limit.
At what point do we look at the speed limit? Do we need to look at the site of the actual accident or before? Because there's obviously, you know, there's a dispute here as to whether it's 45 or 35 where this happened. So I know we have some evidence she exceeded 45, 18, you know, seconds before. What point in time do we look at?
Your Honor, and I think that's why we put the discretion in the trial court, because obviously the trial court's in the best position to evaluate, well, when does that speed become a factor? And the trial court was sitting there, obviously, listening to the evidence, listening to the witnesses, heard what they had to say, and they're in the best position to make that determination, which is why, again, Corsentino gives the trial courts the discretion to make those types of decisions.
See, but I'm sorry, I'm pushing back so much here, but I'm just trying to understand. I'm having trouble. You can't say the court just has discretion to do whatever. The court has to fit within this statute. And it says the court has to make a finding. You exceeded the lawful speed. Well, to find I exceeded the lawful speed, taking aside special hazards, I need to know what the speed limit was at some place and if you exceeded it. And you can't just say there's discretion. I think we need to know, where do you make that? Where was the lawful speed? At the scene of the accident, somewhere before, or what? And I don't think it's sufficient to say the court has discretion. I need your help, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, and in that regard, obviously, we had the trial court heard testimony that the speed limit was no higher than 45. And the trial court also heard testimony that the speed limit where the accident actually occurred was 35 miles an hour. That testimony came through several different witnesses, including the City of Denver's own police officer, Officer Lund, who was the first officer to arrive on scene. Officer Lund prepared an accident diagram indicating that the speed limit where the accident occurred was actually 35 miles an hour, and testified during the Trinity hearing that he prepared that accident diagram right after he arrived on scene as he was looking at the speed limit sign in relation to the location of the accident. The court also heard testimony from Randy and Sharon Massey indicating that the accident occurred after the merge lane ended, which was after the 35 mile an hour sign and in the 35 mile an hour zone. Court also heard similar testimony from both plaintiffs, Ilea Dempsey and Ashkin Zan, further evidencing that this accident actually occurred in that 35 mile an hour zone. And we had the crash data recorder that was stipulated to by the City of Denver indicating that Officer Josie was going 41 miles an hour, 6/10 of a second prior to the impact, which is obviously above that posted speed limit of 35. So I do think the court has ample evidence to say, yes, Officer Josie was above the posted speed limit and exceeded the lawful speeds. I think they're two different things.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Crichton, do you think that the trial court judge's findings were sufficient to show that the Officer Josie was exceeding the maximum lawful speed limits, even though the trial court judge didn't determine specifically what those speed limits were or was?
Candidly, I think obviously the trial court's findings in that regard were imprecise, but I do think the findings are there. Specifically, the court stated, quote, there is also evidence, albeit conflicting, that Officer Josie exceeded the speed limit both prior to and at the time of the impact, depending on where the impact occurred, and also stated, quote, Officer Josie was exceeding the speed limit or may have been going at or about the speed limit at the time of impact. I think the black box said 43, but that was after she clearly applied the brakes before impact. Marks on the roadway would indicate that, end quote. So I do think that he does make that finding, although it certainly could be clear for the appellate court.
Well, part of what you just read was has given me problems since I've been reading the briefs in this case, because the judge said, well, you're exceeding the speed limit or going at or about the speed limit, which sounds like two different things to me. So what is your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think when you look at his statements in the context of what I just alluded to, the crash data recorder, I think it does point out he's somewhat struggling with that situation, but basically is indicating that there is evidence supporting the position that Officer Josie was exceeding the posted speed limit. And there's also evidence for the City of Denver indicating it was below, but clearly he's chosen to accept the testimony indicating that she was above the posted lean, excuse me, posted speed limit, which he's entitled to do as the fact finder. So that's how I would interpret those statements in the context of his ruling, obviously.
Okay, thank you.
Now, getting back to Corsentino, obviously, it's our position that speed should also be considered under the totality of the circumstances. And Judge Boris already alluded to this, the example where an officer, maybe moments before impact, slams on the brakes and thereby is not exceeding the posted speed limit. Obviously, the rationale behind both the statute and Corsentino is not to immunize that officer from liability. And that's the type of situation that you could see fairly regularly in a vehicular pursuit situation, such as the ones described in Tidwell and Quintana, where an accident actually happens well after the officer was actually speeding. And the officer wasn't actually even involved in the actual impact or accident, but obviously the speed still posed an unreasonable risk of danger to life and property and exceeded the lawful speed, and the plaintiff's injuries resulted from the conduct. I think that's another example of how this can just come up and relate to this case, wherein maybe an officer is not speeding at the time of or immediately prior, but still that speed can endanger life and property. So based on the foregoing, Your Honors, I'm asking the court to affirm the trial court's rulings that Officer Josie exceeded the lawful speed, that she endangered life or property while doing so, and that the plaintiff's injuries resulted from her conduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Creighton.
The question of whether or not there's a hazard, I think, just briefly, it has to be a special hazard. And I challenge any police officer to determine, to choose between what's a hazard construction or ICE in the example given by opposing counsel and a special hazard.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
But before we conclude, I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Schwartz, you said at the beginning that there was a question about whether there was an appellant or appellants.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you elaborate on that, please,
yes,
for us?
The court entered an order with respect to the notice of appeal that we filed on behalf of Officer Josie. That issue. And so I was, and that was reserved by the court for oral argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you both for your oral arguments, Mr. Schwartz and Mr. Creighton. Thank you, Mr. Kaufman, for your presence this morning. We appreciate it. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the oral arguments this morning for Division 1. So the court will be in recess and the bailiff may so announce.